Good evening, everyone. Let me say how honored I am to be able to come here. This is my first time in Brussels, and this is a very, very unusual audience for me to address, and so I'm very pleased and also a little bit scared because you know, it's so different from me, my usual experience. And let me thank the organizers of the conference, and especially Mr. Ledoux for Laurent Ledoux for his hospitality and generosity in bringing me here. So with that, I would like to give a very, very fast and, as we would say in America, down and dirty kind of overview of environmental.
You need to speak really in the mic to be heard. Yeah. Really.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to swallow it here as I go. So this will be a very quick overview. Lots of ideas will be broached, sort of almost flashed in a subliminal kind of way, and I hope that some of them will be stimulating for you and that we will have good debate and discussion after we have some refreshment, which we're all very much looking forward to. So let me begin with the first topic here. There we go, thank you. Environmental philosophy began in 1971, basically. It was a product of the 70s. And so the question really arises, why did such a new field in philosophy emerge? And the answer is really very simple and very direct. There was a distinct perception, much stimulated by Rachel Carson, that we are in an environmental crisis. It was both intellectual, that is to say, there was the expression of this in books, but it also addressed our senses. We could literally smell it and taste it in the form of oil spills, fouling beaches and killing shorebirds, and municipal and industrial pollution in rivers. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and the Mississippi River was literally an open sewer in my childhood. We wouldn't dream of entering it to bathe. Smog was choking cities, and there was just a sense that this is something that we it's a profound problem that we need to address. Also, during the 1960s, of course, in the United States and elsewhere, there were other social transformations. I think of it almost as a kind of Western analog of the Cultural Revolution in China. Very different, but there was the war in Vietnam that we were protesting on the streets. There was the Southern Civil Rights Movement, again, Memphis, Tennessee. I was very intimately involved in that. And so students were demanding relevancy in the classroom. Buildings were burning and riots were taking place. And here we were studying Plato and Shakespeare and that sort of thing. We want to bring the issues of the day into the academic environment and into the classroom. So the response then in the 1970s was pretty much as follows. First, pedagogy. The first college course seems to have been taught in 1971 by me, incidentally, at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, which I might say is a sort of peripheral and outline campus far from the centers of power and prestige, which I think is very important because I think that real creativity often, especially in the humanities, begins on the margins. The centers of academic power and prestige are too conservative, too invested in the status quo to really tolerate anything radically new. In 1973, the first, in 75, the first papers were published, the first journal came online in 1979, and since then there has been exponential growth in the field with journal articles, anthologies, monographs, and so on being published. In fact, it's the growth is so great that I cannot really keep up with the literature in the field. I would like to say that there's now also an A to Z encyclopedia, which I was one of the editors in chief, published in 2009. In retrospect, the seminal text for environmental philosophy was published in 1967 by a medieval historian of technology named Lynn White Jr. It was titled The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. It was published in Science, a major journal known around the world, very authoritative. And the argument basically was that the environmental crisis was the product of modern technology, which had been informed by modern science, and as a sort of unintended consequences of this phenomenon, the environmental crisis came about. White then asked the question, well, what is the milieu in which science and technology as we know them came into existence? His answer was basically in the late Middle Ages in Europe. We had the sudden development of some very impressive technologies. Baptiste mentioned Newton and Descartes and the scientific revolution. So the question then, he said, well, what was the sort of worldview, the intellectual milieu in which these phenomena began to be developed? And the answer was in Christendom, essentially. And so he begins then to trace the ideology that drove these phenomena back to the founding texts of the Christian worldview, particularly Genesis chapters 1, 26 through 28, in which human beings are created in the image of God, given dominion over the creation, and actually commanded to subdue it. And White just was saying, well, basically we've lived out this mandate, and here we are with all of the wonderful things that modern technology gives us, but also the environmental problems that it gives us as well. Science may be a little bit puzzling here, but White notes that figures such as Newton basically explained what they were doing as thinking God's thoughts after him as he created the as he created the universe. We being created in the image of God can possibly recreate in our own conceptions this process, this rational process by which God created the world. Now, that was, in my opinion, in retrospect, it was sort of a cavalier and somewhat lurid explanation of the environmental crisis, right? It somehow goes back to Genesis, but there was a subtext that was repeated as a refrain throughout this article, and that is what we do in relationship to the environment depends on what we think about it. And the corollary to that is that if we are going to change what we do, if we're going to change our relationship to the environment, our activities in respect to it, we first have to change the way we think about nature and the environment, indeed about ourselves in relationship to the environment. So we thought that nature was constructed like a giant machine. We thought that we that was engineered by God, that we were sort of junior engineers and that we could rearrange nature in a way, this leading all to the wonderful products of technology, but also to its unintended consequences. So what then must be rethought? Well, very, very simply and directly, the nature of nature, human nature, and the relationship between human beings and the natural environment. Now, thinking about such questions, of course, is the professional activity of philosophers. And so at that point, I know this is hubristic and ridiculous, but it seemed to me and to others of us who were founding the fields that the fate of the world lay in our hands, because we were the ones who had the role of rethinking, which was, is the only way that we can change the way we do and the way we relate to the environment. So it was a heady time and a sense that I have a mission almost like Superman here to come and rescue the environment. So these are, in fact, however, the oldest questions of philosophy. And as Baptiste mentioned, my training was in ancient Greek philosophy. I was very alienated from the small-scale problems of contemporary philosophy, both phenomenology and analytic philosophy. And so this allowed me to think like an ancient Greek. I sometimes think of it as a neo-pre-Socratic style of doing philosophy. So basically, I just mentioned that. So there are two then primary moments in the Kantian sense of environmental philosophy. First of all, it's a critique of the legacy of Western ideas, the sort of way of thinking that has enabled the emergence of an environmental crisis. And then secondly, it's to reconceive the nature of nature, human nature, and the appropriate relationship between human beings and nature. Now, White had begun the critiquing job with the Judeo-Christian legacy, but when Newton, for example, says that he is thinking God's thoughts after him, it's not biblical thoughts, it's the thoughts, really, of the ancient Greek philosophers that were recovered in the Renaissance and began to inform modern science. So what about the legacy of atomism and materialism coming from Democritus, Epicurus, Lucretius, and so on? Think about Plato's otherworldliness, the idea that the real world is this abstract world of forms, and that our natural world is a faint and ephemeral and unimportant imitation of these abstract realities. Then, of course, there is Aristotle's teleological anthropocentrism. Everything is created for an end, and the end of everything is really the pinnacle of humanity to which everything else is really subservient. Then, of course, there is the legacy of modern ideas. Bacon's coercive philosophy of science. Bacon uses the language of witch hunts. We have to torture nature in order to extract her secrets from her. Descartes' dualism, the idea that we are really thinking beings inhabiting these strange machines that from which we are really alienated and different in our bodies. Newton's mechanical philosophy, the private property concepts of John Locke, that we only own property when we mix our labor with it, but of course American Indians and other indigenous people just lived off the land, and so they didn't really own it, and we were able to appropriate it from them for productive purposes. So how then do we go about this job of rethinking this creative aspect of environmental philosophy? White recommended two resources. One was what he called recessive genes, the idea of memes having been coined by them by Richard Dawkins, but it's the same idea. There are some recessive ideas in the Western tradition which we could rediscover and kind of make them not recessive but dominant in future philosophy. He recommended the Pythagorean doctrine of panpsychism, the idea that the soul transmigrates into other creatures, and the Franciscan notion of the animal soul. Heraclitus could well be adopted as the founding father of ecology with his idea of process and flow, the logos, as a principle of dynamic equilibrium among opposing forces like predator-prey relationships, and then of course Whitehead's development of process philosophy, organicism as opposed to mechanism, notions of unity found in Spinoza, and so on. The other possibility would be to look outside the West toward non-Western traditions. White himself suggested Zen Buddhism as an idea. We don't control nature, but we control our desires instead. And also Hindu metaphysics, Taoism, and especially American Indian and other indigenous philosophers. I myself have done some research in all of those categories, which Baptiste has published in French under the title Pensées de la Terre. But in my opinion, that way of going about recreating and addressing these basic concepts of nature, human nature, and the relationship between them is really not going to be very successful, because we need to make a transformation in the worldview, the zeitgeist, not just in some little corner of academic philosophy, but this has to somehow inform the world. And so my preferred approach is to try to give some philosophical interpretation to the second scientific revolution, in which I think that there are some very exciting ideas, both metaphysical and moral, that are coming out of the special and general theories of relativity, quantum theory, evolutionary biology, and ecology. These, in my opinion, are not just sciences, but they also contain, just as atomism and mechanism and Cartesian dualism are more than science, they're a worldview. I think that we have the resources for a new way of thinking about nature in the sciences, and therefore something that we can appeal to with some authority and some confidence that this is part of an international dialogue that can actually affect the way we begin to think about the world. So once again, I would like to affirm that the environmental crisis of the 20th century and also the 21st century, about which I would like to say something, is a crisis of ideas. Once more, I want to emphasize, it raises the oldest questions of philosophy posed by the pre-Socratics, and that is an opportunity and a challenge for us to revisit these and do so in a creative way, inspired by the philosophical dimensions of the second scientific revolution. So let's begin with metaphysics and ontology. Of what is nature composed? Here again, I'm just going to give you a few seminal ideas. This will be just like flashcards here. Is nature really matter or energy? particles or force fields. Ecology provides us with the idea that there are entities that exist beyond organisms, species, biotic communities, ecosystems. These are things that exist perhaps in the world. Where the epistemology is concerned, is ecology an exact environmental science, like, or experimental science like physics, or more descriptive historical science like geology? And further, is science the only way of knowing nature? What about indigenous traditional ecological knowledges about which I think contemporary ecologists are taking a great deal of interest? And then there is the axiological component, and axiology is a fancy name in philosophy for value theory, and that includes both moral and aesthetic value. Is nature, for example, intrinsically valuable? And what is natural beauty? Let me explain just a little bit about intrinsic value. I had a colleague who was a fisheries biologist, and he was concerned with non-game species, little fish that exist in small endemic habitats. And his colleague used to say, well, what good is it after all? Why are you concerned with this little insignificant fish? And he tried to answer this question in all sorts of ways about how these fishes might be put to use. And finally, he gave up and was exasperated. And when one colleague said, what good is this fish? He said, what good are you? That brings out the difference between instrumental and intrinsic value, because we claim intrinsic value, right? And so can we extend the notion of intrinsic value beyond the human somehow to non-human natural entities and maybe nature as a whole? As to beauty, we have various traditions here. Most recently, I think we think of natural beauty in terms of scenery, which ultimately devolves from landscape painting. I remember a friend of mine, we had a seminar at the University of Hawaii, and he had spent a whole week in his dorm room studying, and he finally went to the beach and came back to by our room. We were sharing a room, and he said to me, Baird, it's as pretty as a picture postcard down there. Nature imitates art rather than art imitating nature. But I mean, is natural beauty really scenery, or can we have what Aldo Leopold called a refined taste in natural things, a beauty that's informed by science and by ecology? The general theory of relativity and quantum field theory, I think, gives us the idea that space-time is not a vacuum, but a kind of universal continuum, an underlying reality. Matter and energy are interchangeable configurations of this universal space-time continuum, and there again, I'm not just deriving moral conclusions, but it sets a pattern of thought so that we can have a kind of a touchstone for a moral analogy in which human beings and other organisms are like structured vortices in a flux of matter and energy in dynamic, in a dynamic space-time continuum. Very abstract view of the nature of an organism, but think about it. I mean, we are constantly taking into our bodies the bodies of other things and evacuating and maintaining a certain structure in a continuous flow of matter and energy, as are all other organisms. The Newtonian image of nature was a machine composed of external, related, and interdependent parts. The old ecological image of nature, and I'm a little bit embarrassed here because I just spent the last half hour talking with one of the most distinguished ecologists in Europe, and that was a very great pleasure. We have some friends in common. That the whole system is composed of interdependent parts, each of which are performing functions in relationship to the whole. In fact, the very first paradigm in ecology developed by Frederick Clemens was that ecosystems, as they later came to be called, were superorganisms, and species had functional roles in those organisms, just as we have organs functioning in our bodies. But I think the new ecological image of nature is as a self-organizing system forming an emergent functional whole. Ecosystems self-organize like economic systems. Ecosystem functions are really byproducts of primary survival reproductive activities of the organic components. The ecologist would tend to see, for example, earthworms as aerating soil and recycling detritus. That's their function. But actually, the earthworm is just trying to live, just trying to eat, just trying to reproduce, and its function in the ecosystem is just a kind of side effect of its primary activities. Now, I think in this idea I'm developing, especially for this group, because I think that from what Laurent tells me, that your background is more likely to be influenced by economics than ecology. And I think that in ecology today, there is a revival of one of the oldest ecological metaphors, and that is the metaphor of an economy of nature. And ecology and economy, I might remind everyone, I'm sure you already know, share the same etymology from the Greek oikos, or home. Other species, as Charles Elton in his great book on animal ecology mentioned, occupy niches, he would say professions, in the economy of nature and perform roles there. In fact, in his book, he says the ecologist should think when he sees a badger, there goes the vicar, thinking of his place in the biotic community. So there's a moral principle that follows from this, and that the human economy is a subset of the economy of nature and cannot be sustained unless we sustain the larger economy of nature. We have to achieve a harmony between our economy and this larger economy in which we are embedded. So the economy of nature, which I'm abbreviating as EN, informs the human economy. But in what sense does it inform it? Well, in the economy of nature, materials cycle. The waste of one process is the resource for another, and this is the inspiration in human ecology today for what is known as industrial ecology. Cradle-to-cradle process of recycling nutrients and keeping them out of the landfill or recycling materials. The economy of nature also has, of course, evolved ingenious solutions to practical problems, and now we have people looking at the economy of nature and in terms of the practical problems that we face, and doing so in terms of biomimicry, as it's currently called. But I think that also the human economy informs the economy of nature. Ecological assemblages self-organize from the bottom up, as in a free market economy. Each organism, pursuing its own self-interest, incidentally provides goods and services for others. Just as an entrepreneur is mostly out to make a living and does so by performing goods or providing goods or performing services for others, And furthermore, the economy of nature, like the human economy, is hierarchically organized. Smaller economies are embedded in the larger one, so that we can talk about the economy of Brussels, the economy of Belgium, the economy of Europe, and the global economy, each of which is isolated to some extent from the others, but is also the boundaries are porous, and goods and services cross those boundaries. Now, the UN Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which was published in 2005, develops this ecology-economy of nature analogy and has done its best to express ecosystem values in terms that are translatable into economic valuation. So it has developed four categories of ecosystem services: provisioning services, which would be basically goods, regulating services such as pollination and flood control, supporting services such as oxygen production, soil building, climate control, and cultural services, sacred sites, ethnic identity in relation to place, and that sort of thing. So the concept of services is amenable to economic valuation techniques. They all have either a market price or a shadow price. And the idea was that we've sort of given up on selling people on the intrinsic value of nature. Maybe they will only respond if we can express ecological value in a monetary metric. Where the theory of evolution, I think, is inspiring is that, and I'm very proud of this. I'm proudly an animal. We are, and this is something that I think that we should never really forget, we are exquisitely adapted to the precise conditions on planetary Earth in the Quaternary era, and we alter those conditions at our peril. We are co-evolved with what Arthur called our fellow voyagers in the Odyssey of Evolution, sharing the same Earth, and our genes carry the legacy of ancestral forms going back 3.5 billion years. And this could be the basis, I think, of a kind of eco-spirituality. There is, as Aldo Leopold puts it, my hero, that we should have a sense of wonder over the magnitude and duration of this biological enterprise in which we are just the latest and experimental manifestation. The special theory of relativity, another of the new sciences, doesn't provide any universal or absolute physical frame of reference for assessing motion. That's its essence there. And the moral analogy here is there's no universal and absolute cultural frame of reference for assessing perception and knowledge, which leads to cultural relativism, the validation of alternative epistemologies, knowledges, validation of diversity, pluralism, and validation of multiculturalism. So, what about the relationship between humans and nature? Those were the metaphysical, epistemological issues. The moral payoff of this is environmental ethics. Respect our fellow voyagers in the Odyssey of Evolution and our fellow members of the biotic community. Conceive of the human economy as a subset of the economy of nature and adapt the former to the latter through biomimicry, cradle-to-cradle, industrial ecology, and other means. And conceive of oneself as a node in a vast web of relationships, both social and ecological, which define one's identity, and apart from which one really is nothing. So just a brief overview of some of the basic categories of environmental ethics and how it developed. there is an anthropocentric branch in which the environment is simply a new vector for human-to-human interactions. We affect the environment, it may negatively or positively impact someone else. And the theories of ethics that govern anthropocentric environmental ethics are 18th century, going back to Kant and utilitarians. The non-anthropocentric approach considers human impacts directly on the environment, and it extends, one development of it, one theory extends utilitarian and Kantian concepts of suffering, of rights to animals and plants, but it's just very individualistic. It doesn't really connect with our actual environmental concerns, which are more holistic. And then there is a tradition which I have represented based on the work of David Hume, Charles Darwin, and Aldo Leopold, the moral sentiments, and emphasizes the whole aspects of nature that we're concerned with, species, biotic communities, ecosystems. From Hume, we have the idea that the basis of ethics is in sympathy and loyalty and other such, basically emotions. Darwin suggested that the moral sentiments evolved as a means of social bonding, which were vital to inclusive fitness. And he saw, as human communities grew in size and complexity, the moral sentiments extend more widely, first to family, from family to tribe, to ethnic group, to the nation state, and now to the global village. Probably marked in 1948, this passage to the global level by the United Nations Declaration of Universal Human Rights. Now, Aldo Leopold simply adds an ecological biotic community to this sequence and the land ethic to these other social ethics. And what about the moral value of nature? As we have noted, humans have intrinsic value. Nature has instrumental value, ecosystem services. Does nature have intrinsic value? And I think the answer is yes, if we choose to value it intrinsically. And a good example of that is the U.S. Environmental Species Act, the U.S. Endangered Species Act, which confers a dignity, not a price. That is to say, endangered species are protected regardless of their instrumental value, their monetary worth. Now, intrinsic value is not absolute. Another question might be, well, how do we decide what has intrinsic value? And the answer, I think, is through parliamentary and political processes, like the Endangered Species Act. And finally, intrinsic value is not absolute. It can be overridden by other interests. What it really does, it has the practical effect of assigning intrinsic value to anything, is to shift the burden of proof to competing interests, when competing interests bid to override those of that which we designate as having intrinsic value. So this is a concluding statement, and I'm sure you're all relieved, as am I, that this is the next to the last slide. So we're about to have a glass of wine all together and some further conversation. Once again, the environmental crisis is a crisis of ideas. Incremental changes in business, in industry, and economic processes, a bit of industrial ecology here, biomimicry there, will not get us through the crisis. We need a transformation in the way we think about nature, human nature, and the relationship between humans and nature, between the human economy and the economy of nature. We are evolved beings adapted to specific conditions on Earth. We must value and respect nature. The human economy is a subset of the economy of nature. We must adapt the human economy, the economy of nature, to achieve harmony with nature. And finally, postscript. Our biggest challenge, I think, is global climate change. Global climate change really eclipses all other environmental problems and exacerbates them. And the environmental ethics and philosophy developed over the last 40 years is it or is it not up to the past? I'm not sure that it is, but this is the subject of my current and future research. Do we need an Earth ethic, planetary and spatial scale, and millennial and temporal scale, complement the locally and regionally scaled land ethic and other ethics that have been developed in the field? So I leave you with a thought about the future. Where does climate change take us in terms of an appropriate moral response? I have no answer to that question now, and possibly by next year I'll have a book out on that subject. So thank you very much for your patience.